Danny Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, TVA's Greg David has a conversation with Shelley Scarro. Hailing from Sarnia and then from York University's theater program, Shelley Scarro has a diverse list of television credits to her name. Recent highlights have included showrunner, executive producer, and writer on Ride, and writing for Wynonna Earp. She served as consulting producer and writer on both Lost Girl and Being Erica. She served as creative consultant and writer for the comedy series Sophie. Other credits include Flashpoint, The Kink in My Hair, Instant Star, and Degrassi. Animation work has included writing and story editing for the upcoming girls' action series Mysticons. We'll hear about all of this and more in Greg's conversation with Shelley Scarro.
Shelley, there were a couple of reasons that I wanted to talk to you, and one was the recent Fader story that recalls the Degrassi, The Next Generation episode, Accidents Will Happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to talk to you just because of your overall body of work. I mean, looking at your IMDb page, you've done a lot of writing, you've done a lot of producing, and so I just kind of wanted to talk to you about all that fun stuff, so thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.
But before we get into shows like Degrassi and Being Erica and Wynonna Earp and everything else, so how did you get into writing for TV in the first place? Take me back to the beginning and how it all began.
Oh, God. I started out in theater. So I worked for Garth Drabinski for a long time at the company called Livent.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You must have some great stories.
Oh, dude.
I've seen the documentary.
Oh, yeah?
And it's so good.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. So I worked for him for just straight out of university. That was my first job.
Okay.
And he had a development department. So I was sort of like the Livent D girl, which I didn't even know was a thing.
Yeah.
So I did that for a few years, and then the company sort of famously went under.
Mm-hmm.
And I went traveling for a while with a boyfriend who happened to work in TV.
Yeah.
And he had to come back for a job, and so he got me a job as a PA at Linda Schuyler's Epitome Pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was working as a PA there, and then they needed a development girl. So, a person. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
development
yeah.
person. So it sort of all sort of coalesced, and I worked for about a year there as their development coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, I really felt like I didn't want to give notes anymore. I actually wanted to write the script.
Yeah.
So I went in to try and quit, and Linda offered me the job of story coordinating the very first season of this new iteration of Degrassi. So I jumped on it, and it sort of led directly into writing Degrassi. So what's kind of crazy about that Accidents Will Happen and the Fader article is that was, I think, my fourth script I ever wrote, which is
oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't go to the Canadian Film Center or anything like that?
No. Nope.
Wow.
I know that's sort of the past these days, but
yeah.
Nope. I sort of came in the development door, which was awesome.
Well, okay. So then were you learning how to write scripts when you were at the development stage? Because, I mean, you can't just kind of, you know, sit down and just kind of whip off a script, and certainly not, you know, a Degrassi one, I wouldn't think.
I think you sort of learn it indirectly, right? It's great to go through the process with any writer and sort of watch the drafts grow and change through notes and sort of mm-hmm. figure out what's not working and what is working and, you know, ways to say that to writers and ways for stories to work. So it was actually a really good education that way. And then, yeah, my first season at Degrassi, Aaron Martin was running the show.
Okay.
And Aaron, he was just, it was a tiny, tiny, tiny department. It was me and Aaron and James Hurst.
Yeah.
And the three of us were sort of it for like the full-time staff, which was kind of crazy.
Wow.
Because I wasn't anybody. Like I'd written fiction. I'd written some magazine pieces. I'd written, but not dialogue.
Okay.
And so I Aaron would sometimes let me, you know, work on revisions and write scenes and, write audition bits and all that kind of stuff. And then by second season, I was offered a script. So it was great.
I mean, you know, you talk about Linda, you talk about Epitome, you look at people's work, especially, you know, Canadian television writers, and pretty much everybody, I think, has gone through the Degrassi world at one point or another and have gone on to other things. So, I mean, that's like, if it was yourself and Aaron and James basically in the room, I mean, that's a crash course in television writing right there.
It really was. It felt like we were sort of at school with our characters and sort of the intensity of going, all going to school together, just like in there all day, every day, and just making mistakes and working things out. It was great.
So then you said off the top that you started out on The Next Generation, right? At ground level when Next Generation started.
I was there for the year that it was developed and pitched.
So. Wow, that's crazy. Because at that point, I was at TV Guide Canada, and I came out to the set and was interviewing everybody, you know, because there was this new generation. We had new characters. We had Emma and Manny and and all of these people. And so that was, wow, that's, well, we won't talk about how long ago that was, but that was quite a long time ago.
Fairly long time ago.
So had you fell into the job, but had you ever wanted to write for television, or had that not even been on your radar?
This is going to sound really naive. I felt like I didn't know that it was a job that I could strive for.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to be a playwright. I wanted to be an actress. I sort of circled around, but I'm from, you know, a smaller town in southern Ontario, and I don't think I knew it was a job.
Okay.
It sounds nuts now. And I would hope that, like, 17-year-old me's would now know that it's an actual job.
Yeah.
But at the time, I just didn't know to dream of it.
So when you say small town in southern Ontario, do you mind saying where you're from?
I'm from Sarnia.
Oh, I'm from Brantford.
Are you?
Yeah, yeah.
Represent.
Good old Sarnia, the 519.
Yeah, man.
So, okay, well, we'll get into more Sarnia when we later on in our chat. No, it'll be a good thing. I'm going to get back to Degrassi in a few minutes, but I did want to talk about Sophie.
Oh yeah.
Not only because I feel like it was canceled too soon, mm-hmm. but you were in a room. I looked at the room at the time, and we're talking Sherry White, Anita mm-hmm. Capilla. I went to school with Anita. She's from Brantford as well. Cynthia Knight, Emily Andrus, the aforementioned James Hurst, your husband. I mean, what was that writer's room like?
Oh, tremendously fun. It was sort of the same thing. It was like the first season we had it was really me and Howard. And then we had some freelancers, and it sort of worked out that the show was shooting in Montreal. So there was mm-hmm. this sort of insane idea that we would go and write in Montreal.
Yeah.
So it was me and Howard, and then we were sort of desperate for someone to bounce comedy off. And James, because he was my husband, happened to be in town.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, no, really, he's very funny. He's funnier than me. Bring him in.
Right.
So he came in, and we sort of limped through the rest of the first season that way. Like, we just sort of, like, killed ourselves. And then second season, Howard successfully argued to move the show to Toronto, and that's mm-hmm. when we got in so many fun people. And the second season was super crazy fun times.
I first met Howard on the set of An American in Canada.
Oh yeah.
And that was such a good show. I really just don't think it ever got the, like so many shows in this country, sadly, I just didn't get the kind of props or the number of eyeballs that it really deserved.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know what? Thank you so much for bringing that one up, because I really loved Sophie, and I did feel like it didn't necessarily land the way it should have. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back to Degrassi and let's talk about this this Fader article. You know, it's no secret that the franchise has covered, you know, unflinching storylines from the very beginning. I remember watching Degrassi, the original Degrassi, and then when I was in college, everybody in college would watch it as well. So Accidents Will Happen is about Manny deciding to have an abortion, and you were nominated for a Gemini for that episode. Along with, was it Nicole?
Nicole Demers and James Hurst.
And James Hurst.
Had the story credit on it. Yep.
So what do you remember? I mean, you said that was what, your fourth script?
I think so. I would have to go back and like be absolutely sure, but it was definitely like under five scripts I'd written by that point, which is kind of crazy.
That is crazy. But yeah. Like, what do you remember about writing that script? Like when you guys were writing it, did you feel as though this was something that was going to resonate? Aside from the storylines that usually resonate, I mean, Degrassi resonates with generations, but did it feel special at the time?
I think it did sort of. I mean, when you're running a whole department, we had all kinds of crazy sort of it goes there stories happen mm-hmm. that year. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, the reason it stuck out was a standards problem more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because honestly, we were really writing from character. We were like, what's the right thing for this character? Like, where are they right now in their life, and what would be something that would challenge them? And yes, we had issues and we would pull issues in and work with issues, but we worked really hard to make sure that they were sort of germane to who the characters were. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't think about it as much as I did afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
So the problem was sort of getting it past American standards.
Yeah.
So it had a lot of attention on that front. Which isn't necessarily the kind of attention that you want on a script as a writer, you know? Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about the story resonating with viewers as much as I was trying to tell the best story I could about Manny.
Yeah.
But which also would fit a network standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
So what had to change? And it was kind of ironic that you had to change something for standards in the U.S. and that the episode wasn't broadcast.
They sort of at every level, it just went through S&P. And I will say, like, the people we worked with at the time were absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, they were dream executives in terms of like you really felt like they wanted to put the show on, and they really were behind the story we were telling and behind what we were doing. So they were on it 100%, but it was sort of the people up the chain from them.
Yeah.
And it really, what was good about it ultimately was that all they were really demanding was sort of fair-handedness.
Okay.
Which is something that I would hope as a good writer you would do anyway for a story like that. Like,
sure.
For a young girl to make that decision.
Yeah.
Part of the reason for telling that story was to hear everybody's side. So that's the part that they really wanted to make sure was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it did, and I like to think it would have anyway, because that was the reason for doing it.
Right. Had you watched the original Degrassi?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you knew, and of course, you know, going into the room, you knew that the storylines are all, you know, always based in truth and what's really going on with teens. Mm-hmm. And that must have been really important to you as well, to be telling those stories as real as they were. And abortion has never been, I mean, it's been covered on Degrassi before.
Yeah.
But it must have been, what's it like writing? I mean, you wrote for kids in Ride, but what's it like writing for a show like Degrassi, where basically you can write about anything? Like, nothing's really off the board, right?
I think it's a very unique experience and a very unique show. And
yeah.
It's one of those things where, like, as a young person, in any job, you sometimes don't know what amazingness is happening around you.
Sure.
If it's too early in your career. And yeah. I don't think I appreciated at the time sort of mm-hmm. how special that little microcosm is. And I mean, it was Linda always knew sort of what her show was.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most important rules was like, it's always at the kid level. And it just gave us a lot of permission to like be honest about the high school experience and yeah. like not, she always sort of famously tells the story that when she did the first series that PBS wanted like a nice lady on the corner who the kids would go and talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, yeah, that's bullshit. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And so there was a freedom. She fought for that. I think in kids TV, there's a tentativeness that they sort of want to model. There's a desire to model things positively and like, you should talk to adults because adults are there and let's show that, you know. And Linda just was not something to be done. She just was like, no, that's
mm-hmm. yeah.
Now, ironically, in the abortion episode, we do actually have probably more conversations with adults.
Yeah.
But that's because Spike had gone through the experience herself.
Yes.
So it was sort of coming from that point of view as opposed mm-hmm. to like, here's a wise mom who's going to help you figure shit out.
Mm-hmm.
So it, sorry, I don't remember where I was going with that.
No, that's okay.
I think just that it's sort of a special kind of writing for kids and teens that I haven't found since. I guess just like this sense of, be blunt, be honest, and don't worry about making it feel safe.
Yeah, and I guess also if you have a show like Degrassi on your resume, I think in this country especially, that's really saying something. If you've been through the Degrassi franchise, you really know how to write unflinching television. Do you feel that way?
I think so. On good days. On bad days, on bad days, I think people who haven't watched the show as much or haven't watched it in a long time, there is sort of a brush that you get tarred with as well, which is like earnest or melodramatic.
Mm.
And that's, you know, as a writer, that's not something you want associated sure. with yourself yeah. in general,
yeah.
but it just definitely lowers your flexibility in terms of going in for other jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I know that network executives have in the past sort of said, is she too like straight up and sweet for this? And people are like, no, have you met this woman? But it just like Degrassi strikes that chord with people. They're like, oh, that, you know? So that's...
Oh, really? I didn't think it would have a negative connotation.
I don't mean to bring out the bummer side. It just, like, it sort of can pigeonhole you a little bit as, like,
okay.
funny or something.
Okay. Huh.
You know?
Because it definitely does have its funny moments. It isn't all about, you know,
yeah.
ODs and shooters in the high school.
I agree. But I think you have to watch that to know it, right?
Right,
and so
right.
There are people who haven't watched it since they were 16 or
right.
whatever. And so
right.
it's sort of gotten stowed away as like, oh, right, the issue show.
right. Yeah.
Yeah, like special of the week.
Right. Yes, the TV movie of the week, the boy that drank too much.
Yeah, exactly. Like the bipolar boy who drank too much and shot up heroin and then decided he wanted to be a girl and then actually had to get an abortion and then fell off a bridge. Like, yeah.
I think you just broke a story.
Oh, yeah. It's no problem in my street.
So before we take a break, one last question about Degrassi. And so after working on that show, what did you learn about yourself as a writer?
Oof. I learned about myself as a writer.
Did it build up your confidence as a writer?
Oh, my God. Of course. Definitely.
Yeah.
Like it definitely, you felt like you were doing something good and
mm-hmm.
cool.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, not cool, but recognizable, I guess. Like, you know, you were working on a show that people knew about, which is great for your first job. Like, that's nuts. Mm-hmm. It's like more than you could hope for. But I think what I loved about it that I think gets underrated is that it was an ensemble show.
Yeah.
And this is something that people forget, which is that every episode when you come back, it's about a different character.
Mm-hmm.
And very few other shows are that. And so what was great about it was voice. I think that's something I have ended up feeling really good about as a writer. And that's where I would trace it back to, is like being able to say, oh, shit, like this week I have to write a Rick episode. So like, what is Rick's voice?
You know?
And how is this Rick story different than the Emma voice that I was just writing?
Mm-hmm.
So that there was no like scuttling into a comfort zone, which you can sometimes do on another show, right?
Right.
So you couldn't do that. You'd be like, oh crap, like I have to do the Jimmy episode. Like, what about me is cool enough to write for Drake? Nothing, literally. but I had to, you know? So I think voice played a huge role.
Yeah, it still amazes me the size of that cast and how they're able to jam so much into a half an hour every week.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a little break before we move on and talk about some other things in your career. And I know that you've listened to the podcast before, so you know that there's the drink update.
Yes,
and because we're recording it just before 9 o'clock p.m., we can have adult beverages. So tonight, earlier this evening, I had a Coronita, which is a little Corona.
Hmm.
Yes, so that's what I had, because that's basically all the alcohol that we have in the house besides some harder stuff that I didn't want to get into. So
yeah, I thought you have like a whole cupboard.
Well, we do have a cupboard. I could have had some writer's tears, but I wanted to be kind of have my wits about me. So that's what I had.
Writer's tears do not contribute to having your wits about you.
No. So what about you? Are you enjoying an adult beverage? Are you having a tea, a water, Kool-Aid? What are you having?
I decided to get into the spirit of it, man. I'm having like a proper amaretto sour.
Oh, what's in that? Amaretto?
Amaretto, lemon juice, and a little bit of simple syrup. And you throw it on the rocks and it's delicious.
Do you make your own simple syrup?
Yeah, sure.
Wow. So that's just water and sugar, right?
Yeah. Equal proportions, and you boil it and until you can't see the sugar anymore, and then you can put it in the fridge for like ages.
Wow. Good for you.
I think this is actually simple syrup left over from Christmas, if that helps it sound less enterprising and Martha Stewart-y.
I think that that's probably the best drink that I've heard somebody have since Dark and Stormy, which I had never heard of before. Eric Johnson, Canadian actor from The Nick. Is that his first name? Eric? Yeah. Nice. Yeah. He did the podcast with Anthony Marco and he had a Dark and Stormy, and I had never heard of that one before.
Mm-hmm.
So an amaretto sour. So when did you first have one of those?
You know what? Do you know the Keg Mansion?
Yeah.
So, like, when I was younger and we thought the Keg Mansion was an amazing place.
Sure.
We would go, and my brother lived in Toronto, and he would take me there, and we would get, like, the keg size. And I don't know how we ended up on an amaretto sour. I think only because it had, like, less mix in it, so you would get drunker faster. Also, I like things with maraschino cherries in them.
Ah.
So it started there, which is really weird.
I do remember when I was younger that I would go for the drinks that had the more booze to mix, and that was why I would drink Long Island iced teas.
Oh, yeah, man. That's very Southern Ontario of you, I think.
That they were expensive, but I didn't have to spend as much money because it didn't take long.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. You get me one keg-sized amaretto sour, I am good.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, I'm glad that you're imbibing and that you're embracing the adult beverage aspect of the podcast. Thank you.
I'd love to be in the pantheon of good drink choices.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one. All right, so let's get back to your career. Let's talk about your experience on Lost Girl. And you were a writer and a consulting producer on that, right?
Yeah, I did a season on Lost Girl. Yeah.
So who's the showrunner at that time?
It was a strange season. Michelle Lavretta had just left.
Right.
And Emily had done a season, but she was off on maternity leave.
Okay.
So there was sort of, and then when I got there, it was Jeremy Boxen.
Yeah, okay.
And Grant, oh my God. Oh, you have to edit this out.
No, I'm leaving it in.
The amaretto sour's gone to my head. Oh shit, it's totally gone.
That's all right. That's what IMDb is for. I'm plugging it in right now.
It was replaced by another Greg in my head.
Okay, so let's see here. We've got... What was his first name?
Grant.
Grant Rosenberg.
Thank you!
Yeah,
you.
There we go.
That's the one. So it was Grant Rosenberg and Jeremy Boxen the year that I was there.
But, okay.
Like, Jeremy wasn't there the whole season. He was, like, contracted for a certain amount, and then he left, and then Grant was there for a certain amount. So it was a tough season. It was a bit tricky that way.
Yeah, that must have been, you know, not only did you have that shakeup, but now all of a sudden you're on a show that's genre-based,
yeah.
You know, very different from Lost Girl. So what was that experience like going from, you know, going into the whole genre angle?
It was tricky. I mean, what was helpful is that I had worked with Emily a ton.
Yeah.
And I knew sort of Emily's voice, and I'd worked with Michelle a little bit, and I sort of felt like I knew Michelle. So, mm-hmm. You know, when you go in on a show like that, it's sort of your job to really jump into the style of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like having worked with both of them, even though I wasn't working with them at the time,
yeah.
Their voices were so strong that it was okay to sort of hop in. The genre thing was really challenging because you have to be sort of more open to wild possibilities. And,
yeah.
And when you've trained yourself to think in sort of the more normal drama space, it's mm-hmm. hard to sort of go like, oh, I know a monster, you know, it's this kind of crazy monster and it comes out of the outlet in the wall and it jumps into the vacuum and that's how it possesses, you know, it's just like, yeah. That's totally different than when you actually have to work out, something real world.
Mm-hmm.
So giving yourself that freedom is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about, you know, you've mentioned the word voice a couple of times and mm-hmm. finding somebody's voice. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to be a chameleon when you're moving from show to show. If it's somebody like Michelle Lavretta or it's Aaron Martin with Degrassi, you have to kind of know what the showrunner's voice is and then apply it to, as well as the character voices, right?
Absolutely. That's like, that's your key job as a freelancer or a staffer, is to catch the voice of the show, which is the voice of the showrunner. And having sort of been on that side myself as well, like, nothing makes you more grateful than when someone gets that, you know, mm-hmm. when somebody knows what's a joke that belongs on your show and what's a joke that wouldn't be on your show in a million years. And sort of that ability as a writer to discipline yourself to not put in that joke that you think is hilarious.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't suit the show or doesn't suit the character. Like, they would never say that. They would never do that. I love it, I have to say. Like,
yeah.
I like getting to know different showrunners and getting to know their different peccadilloes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it must feel great when you get into that groove, when you're chugging along and you're in that zone and you've got all the voices in your head. And that must be – does that happen – does it come to you fairly easily, or is it something that where sometimes you really struggle at it?
Both, you know?
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
It can be super easy. Like, somebody like Aaron, obviously I've worked with him for, like, ages now.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I always know what's going to crack him up.
Yeah.
And what's going to punch him in the gut in a positive way.
Yeah.
And same thing I feel like with Emily and James, and just like, it's great to get sort of a group of writers whose instincts you know and who know yours. Like it takes time. It takes space to sort of develop that relationship, and it feels great when you've got it. But then the same token, it's really fun to climb inside another person's voice. Like right now I've been working with Sean Hara on it's a new animated show called Mysticons that's coming out.
Yeah.
And Sean is like, he's his total own thing, and I think we're on episode 40 now of Mysticons, and I've been story editing for him. So, like, as story editor, like, my job is often to talk to the writers and try and explain how Sean's brain works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally different brain. So it's really fun to jump inside and figure out what kind of scene would turn him on, you know?
Well, and what kind of writer are you? Are you able to sit in the writer's room with a bunch of other people and be working on a script, or do you need to have to go somewhere quiet to do that work?
Either one.
Yeah. Look at you, man.
I'm sounding very like middle of, am I sounding very middle of the road or adaptable? One or the other.
Yeah. So you don't need to be, do you need to have like a favorite, like do you need to have things a certain way, or you're all good?
Nah, I'm all good. I'm like better in a bit of a storm. Like I'm a coffee shop writer and a library writer and a on the floor writer and, you know, just wherever, whenever.
Wow. Totally adaptable. Good for you.
As long as there's an amaretto sour.
Yeah, there you go.
Joking.
That must go really well when you're smuggling them into the library.
Do that. Yeah, seriously, right?
Another show I wanted to talk to you about was Ride. And I mean, I'm a 46 year old guy, so I'm definitely not the demographic, but I really like Ride.
You do?
So how did, yeah, smartly written, very well done. I'm hoping, you know, I keep seeing tweets about it, but it's because it's airing down in the States right now, because I keep hoping that there's going to be a second season, and we still, at least I haven't heard. Yeah, I haven't heard anything yet. But so talk to me a little bit about how you teamed up with Jill and Lori and ended up on that show.
Well, okay, so it's all connected because I used to, Matt Heater, who's now on Degrassi.
Yeah.
Matt is from Sarnia. We actually went to the same high school.
Okay.
And then he had worked with my agent for a while, so I knew him from that. And then he went on to work at Degrassi. And he had done a development period with Jill and Lori. And when it came time to do the show, he couldn't. He was having a baby, and I think Degrassi was going for another season. So he sort of recommended me for the job. And I went in and talked to Jill and Lori and Joan Lambert at Breakthrough. And just like jumped straight in, because that show was an absolute whirlwind. It was, the timing on that was nuts. I think I started like the second week of October, and we were shooting the beginning of January. Like it was mental.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like Lara Azzopardi with Backstage, only she was pregnant at the time too.
I know. Lara's superwoman. Yeah.
So were you able, what about the writer's room for Ride? Were you guys in the UK or were you here the whole time?
We were here. So we broke the episodes here in October, went off and wrote November and December. And then Lori and Jill and I were in Toronto for the Toronto shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went over to Ireland. So I was there the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah. It was five weeks in Ireland.
Now, so what was that like from, like watching, like, did you watch them film, and I'm assuming you were tweaking scripts and that the whole time, right?
Yeah. A little bit. I mean, it was super hard because we had already shot all the interiors.
Yeah.
So you can only tweak so much. And
right.
We had not, like, I felt like we never had quite enough time to shoot the show. So we were trying to figure out cuts like on the fly. And when you already had the episodes like 75% of the way in the can, it's really hard to do. It was the toughest producing job I've had, I'll say that.
Really? Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And what were the crews like?
Oh, fantastic. Oh, my God. I mean, here, Jill and Lori, having worked in the industry as ADs for a long time, they knew great people. I contributed some people, too. And we had a fantastic crew here. We just shot, like, stank, just, like, nuts.
Yeah.
And the crew in Ireland were amazing. They were magical because a lot of them were Game of Thrones crew. It's Northern Ireland, right?
Yeah.
That's who you're going to get. So we had Game of Thrones crew who people were like fangirling all over. And The Fall, a bunch of them had done The Fall, and a bunch of them had done Penny Dreadful.
Oh, so, wow.
I know. And we get them on our little kids show. So, I mean, I think that's a big part of why that show looks as great as it does for the $20 it was shot on is the crews were fantastic.
You know what? That's got to be it because it looks, production-wise, looks fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty hard, though, to make a show look like crap when it's being filmed in Ireland.
It was beautiful, but I have to tell you, like, we were on the coast. We were, like, about an hour north of Belfast.
Okay.
On the coast, looking over to Scotland. And, like, honestly, you know that old joke where they're like, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes?
Yeah.
And Steve Skaney, the director who I worked with a lot on the show and who I, like, love and adore, he said he shot a bunch of that show in Newfoundland.
Republic of Doyle?
Yeah, he shot a bunch of Doyle. And he said the thing out there is if you don't like the weather, go look out the back door. that's the Newfoundland version. And
okay.
In Ireland, it was like, honestly, if you don't like the weather, turn around. It was crazy, like this little microclimate.
Yeah.
Our poor first AD was English and was trying to plan the days around the weather. And it took like a week to realize, like, you can't. Like, you're just going to have to do what you're going to have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And because we were supposed to be all exteriors over there, we had basically like a month of all exteriors and a little bit of stables. We had virtually no rain cover, and we just had to shoot no matter what happened.
Yeah, wow.
So color correct on that show was really key.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know, you've worked, like Degrassi, Ride has a large ensemble cast of kids. Talk about these kids. I mean, you've had the experience with Next Generation and you know, working with a young Drake. What about someone like Kendra or Alana or, I mean, Johnny Gray, who's becoming like a superstar for YTV? Talk about, you know, this kind of new generation of talent.
Yeah, I mean, there's a slight difference in that in Degrassi, I think they've bent a little bit on it now, but at the time that I was doing it, Linda was really stuck on the kids being the actual age that they were portraying.
Yeah, okay.
It gives it a super rawness, like it gives it a real, you know, when Cassie Steele shot those abortion episodes, she was legit 14 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
Man.
There's a feeling around that, right? There's a vulnerability that is almost kind of beyond the actor. Part of it is being 14, you know?
Okay.
You can't fake that. So one of the slight differences with Ride is that we needed to have actors who were over 18.
Yeah.
But the sort of trade-off is that we got like amazing professionals. I have to tell you, Kendra is the star that every show would dream of. She's just like, she's that number one on the call sheet that every producer wants. Like, no matter what's going on, she's there, she's prepared, she's excited, she's happy, she's nice to everybody, she's just a pro. And Johnny is hilarious and a dream come true and makes everything better. And our English cast were great. Most of them were really green. Like, three of them had done virtually no TV before.
Whoa.
And, you know, we're asking them to block shoot. Like, by the time we got to Ireland, we were block shooting up to 16 episodes at a time, which is
wow.
really hard.
Yeah.
there would be days when Kendra would shoot, like, I think there were days when she shot from, like, something, a scene for episode 1 and a scene for episode 20 in the same day. And to keep the continuity of character and to, like, keep that whole journey in your head.
Yeah.
She was a genius. Just a genius. It's not an easy feat, you know?
I think people, you know, the block shooting, I think, you know, not very many people outside of the industry that just regularly sit down and watch TV don't understand that block shooting is kind of like the way to go, especially when it comes to Canadian TV. And mm-hmm. I still don't know how people, you know, whether you're an actor or you're a member of the crew, how you can keep that kind of stuff straight.
Mm-hmm. I know. And I, like, in my regular life, have virtually no memory, but you kind of can go into, like, a beautiful mind state. Like, I knew when I was shooting that show, I knew every scene, every page would sort of, like, go through my mind.
Yeah.
You know, in the weirdest possible way, so that I could say, like, well, this connects to episode 3, which connects to 6, which connects to 9, and the reason this is happening now is blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
And then it's all gone now. It's all finished. And that's probably why I can't remember names anymore. Because I've spent all of it. If I haven't spent it on children, I've spent it on block shooting. My mind is gone.
So, like you said earlier, no word on a season 2 for Ride yet.
Well, I mean, fingers crossed, man. Fingers crossed. I hope it. I know it did well in Canada. I know YTV was really happy with it. I think it did well internationally. I know Nickelodeon Europe was happy. Mm-hmm. So the Americans, you know, they always have the biggest stake in everything, and everybody has to wait for them. So fingers crossed.
Okay, so just a few more questions. I can hear somebody in the background sounds very upset, so you probably don't have a lot of time left.
Sorry. That's no. The reason I'm drinking the Amaretto.
Yeah. You hear the crying, just keep on sipping.
I'm so sorry.
No, please don't worry about it. It adds authenticity.
It's like they know. I think they know.
Well, it was like my cat. I don't know whether you heard my cat or not, but he decided to come by and meow and ring his collar. So that's okay. I'll fix it in post. No, I won't. So a couple more questions. And one of them is, so you're from Sarnia and you grew up in Sarnia, right?
Yeah.
So were there kids' TV shows that you grew up watching that kind of shaped who you are? Like, for me, it was, you know, I can go as young as, you know, Mr. Dress Up and the Polka Dot Door and the Friendly Giant. And then, like, up through the 80s with the A-Team and Magnum. What about you?
You know what's funny is, like, there just weren't that many kids' TV shows. Like, it's like you say, like, I remember Mr. Dress Up and Captain Kangaroo, Sesame Street, all of those. But then it was like there was like a long period where you were just sort of expected to watch adult shows.
Mm.
And Sarnia was really weird because we got Detroit Television.
Yeah.
And so Detroit Television was all these old sitcoms. It was like we had I Love Lucy and the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah.
And what else? Like, so I watched The Brady Bunch.
Oh, yeah. oh, yeah.
That's the lowest your voice has gone to. What's going on with you and Marsha? But so I watched all of those all the time. Or Sanford and Son, bizarrely, I was obsessed with.
Right.
Weird stuff.
No, I'm exactly the same way. You know, the Jeffersons, Archie Bunker, you know, all those shows that my parents were watching, so that I just automatically saw them as well.
Yeah, and you try to explain to your kids now, like, my kids are all over the Roku and YouTube, and they're like 7, and they know how to find any show anytime, anywhere, and they're bewildered when I tell them, like, no, honestly, there were 12 channels,
mm-hmm.
and if Papa wanted to watch the Jeffersons, we watched the Jeffersons.
Yeah.
They don't get it.
Yeah. It must be interesting to have kids that are this new generation. You know, YouTube just announced, I think it was yesterday or the day before, this $35 package that you'll be able to get 40 channels down in the States. I mean, this is a whole new generation of viewers. So are they watching everything on, are they just watching YouTube and like Netflix?
Yeah. They find like obscure weird shows on Netflix, like weird Russian cartoons, and watch those. But it's this thing too where like nobody at school is watching the same stuff anymore either. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, as someone who's trying to make TV, you're like, how do I cut through all that?
Yeah.
But what's sort of fun about it is that my kid like thinks he can make TV, which is fun.
Yeah.
No, he wants a green screen so that he can be Dan TDM on YouTube. It's
wow.
I know. Savage.
And you could probably just take a green screen, just show up at Epitome and just take something and just put a bow on it and give it to him.
Yeah, totally. I know, that's the problem, is that I get all like micromanagey about it, which is, like, yeah. Takes the fun out of it when you're like, okay, so I think we should do another take, sweetie. Like, I know you were just sort of saying what came into your head, but why don't we make some notes about what you want to say? And then he's like, oh, fuck this, you're no fun.
Ooh. This isn't fun. Yeah, come on, Mom.
Yeah.
Mom turns into the executive, the network exec.
Exactly. And like, it is not fun at all. Sorry, but you can't help it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But does it scare you as a person that's creating TV to see your own kids consuming it in a different way?
No, because I think they serve different purposes, right? Like, I feel like kids aren't necessarily watching the sitcoms that their parents are watching or the hour-longs that their parents are watching. So some of that space has filled in with YouTube, but I think they love to find their thing. Mm. They love to find their show, the show that sort of speaks to who they are. And I know, like, with Ride, like, you know, there's the horse-crazy girl, there's the Anglophile kid, there's, like, this subgenre of kids who really wish they went to boarding school.
Yeah.
And so they find the show and they talk about it and sort of love it more intensely than they would if it was just what was on Channel 12.
Hmm.
You know, and I think that's what it is for my sons too, is like they choose what they love. They choose what speaks to them. So that's good.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. And so they're not just watching the YouTube video. Then after the YouTube video, they're like, okay, let's watch Teen Titans Go. And it's like,
right.
Two things kind of inform each other.
Cool. Okay. And then last question, you already mentioned Mysticon. So can you, and I was just taking a look at it, an upcoming animated action television series planned for release in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
A collaboration between companies Nelvana Limited, Playmates Toys, The Topps Company, and Nickelodeon.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. You're all going to love it.
It will be aimed towards girls and was originally described as a series that aimed towards boys, but changed demographics during development to instead target girls age 6 and up.
Yeah.
So what can you say about it?
Oh,
where
my
are
God.
You at in the process?
It's really fun. We're just writing the last, we're like on episode 34.
Oh, episode 34.
I know. Well, because it's animation, right? So you just have to keep going so that, that the poor people in the basement can keep drawing and drawing. the show has an amazing director, Matt, and he is like, it's the same thing I was saying with block shooting. He's like still doing finishing edits on episode 2 and then giving notes on the script for episode 36 and mm-hmm. on different stages on every script in between. It all falls on the director. In that sort of area, but it's really fun. It's a much more action-y show than I've ever seen aimed at girls.
Okay.
It's set in sort of like a weird fantasy futuristic utopia, but there's like, well, not utopia. There's it's sort of, Sean's a real Dungeons and Dragons fan.
Okay.
So we have dwarves and pixies and unicorns and golems and all kinds of amazing stuff sort of from that world. And then the Mysticons are four teenage girls who find that they're sort of the protectors of their city and their world. And I just love that somebody's doing that for girls. Like I, you know, again, like my, I'm such like boring mom, just take it all back to your kids. But I know that my son at school, the girls are outside playing superheroes next to the boys. So I just am so happy that they're being given the amazing heroes that Sean has created on this show.
Is there a Canadian network attached to it?
Yeah, YTV.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And then how many people in the writer's room?
What did we have in the last one? Like a lot. 1, 2, 7 of us. 8 of us? Yeah.
Wow. Is that the biggest room you've been in?
One of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we had to break so many episodes and sort of farm them out. Sean, you know, had 6 writers working on different episodes at once. So it was fun. Really, really fun show.
And then is it kind of like genre, like Lost Girl, where there's kind of the sky's the limit, like literally when it comes to the storylines?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. There's like we honestly have like flying griffins and flying unicorns and, you know, exploding towers and golems with hearts full of lava pouring out. And it's great. Crazy.
And I'm assuming because Playmates Toys is a partner in this, that there's going to be you know, a toy line to go along with the show.
Yeah, they're all over that. And that's exciting. I've never been on a show that there's been toys before, I don't think.
You're going to get free stuff.
I hope so, man. There's like one character. She's sort of like girl Han Solo. She's the awesomest. And she has short hair, which the girls in Nickelodeon testing really responded positively to because no one gives them that, which is the weirdest thing when you think about it. So she's like a cool chick with short blue hair, and I'm totally getting the action figure of her. I think I'm gonna go as her for Halloween next year.
Well, thanks to Shelley Scarrow for sitting down and talking with Greg David about some of the great work that she has done over her career, and thanks to all of you for listening to TV ABCs. If you listen to TV ABCs, maybe you also listen to our alternate week podcast, which is when Greg and I sit down and talk about the business, the programming, all of that different stuff about Canadian television. We believe we are one of the few, if not the only, solely Canadian television podcasts out there. And if you would like to support us, please feel free to do that by going to our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/TV_EH. And if you think it's worth $1 a month, $1 an episode, whatever you want to contribute, it's kind of like a micro-payment approach for us to create content and to help us out along the way. Feel free to do that. Go there and help us out. You can follow us on Twitter at TV_EH. You can follow Greg on Twitter at Greg_David. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. And we'll keep on bringing these podcasts back to you on a weekly basis. You might be hearing about the news sometimes or the upcoming calendars, or you might be hearing about great interviews with people who are willing to sit down and talk to us about doing what they love so that we can do what we love, which is bringing that information to you. Don't forget to check back to the website regularly, tv-eh.com, for all of your Canadian television news. Make sure you check there, subscribe, do whatever you need to do. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.